This is Leon Goldenberg with another edition of Community Matters. As part of my ongoing program, I will be interviewing people that are running for office, whether it's on citywide, the mayor's office, city controller, and many of the council races, because that's all the races that are going on. And tonight I have somebody who's running for controller of the city of New York, who I've gotten to know during the COVID period. So we actually have not met face-to-face, but we've been on several Zoom calls. And it's my pleasure to invite Brian Benjamin, who's right now a state senator in District 30, which encompasses Harlem, East Harlem, and the Upper West Side. He was born in Harlem, so he's representing his own community. He has an MBA from Harvard, and he went to Brown University. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Leon. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the second most important job in the city is the controller. You control some $200 billion. Am I correct with that amount?
$248 billion is the last count.
The last count. That's okay. So, I'll take that extra $48 billion that I didn't mention. So you have to invest the money. That's part of what you do. But you also have to watch. You sign off on every, because most people don't realize what the control does. You sign off on every contract that the city signs. And then you review and audit all the city agencies. What else is it that the city controller does that you think is important?
The city controller make sure that all of the borrowings of the city of New York runs through the comptroller's office. And so, the capital budget, the financing of major projects across the city, that all of that borrowing happens through the comptroller's office. And also the comptroller also can settle lawsuits, exactly.
Right.
So that is a real issue as well. But you did a good job of kind of stating the major functions.
Right. Because it really is a huge responsibility. The current comptroller and the past comptrollers, the ones that were effective, were reviewing those contracts, pointing out where there were really issues that weren't. What do you see as you're going to add to it? What is your focus going to be?
Absolutely. So first of all, thank you for that question. I think, I did neglect to mention that the comptroller also is responsible for setting prevailing wage and enforcing prevailing wage in the city of New York. But these are the priorities that I have. Number one, we need to, the next comptroller needs to be part of helping the mayor and the city get through economic recovery. So that means being on top of making sure that we're getting everyone vaccinated, and that we're helping to bring back tourism in the city of New York. We're helping to bring back Broadway, our small businesses in the city of New York. How do we do that? One of the key ways that we do that is we make sure that we, for once and for all, get our arms around the police accountability and public safety concerns in the city of New York. As you know, we have had some very high-profile trials and cases around police misconduct and the accountability around that. At the same time, we're having an increase in shootings, we're having an increase in random acts of violence, we're having some quality of life issues that require law enforcement as well. So how do we do this in a way that makes
sense? So you're not for defunding the police?
No, what I am for is making sure that every single police dollar is going towards our public safety. And so if that then ends up having less money in the police department, then I'm for that. And let me explain why I say that. I think there are, in my district, there are a number of issues that happen where mental health is the first order of business. Or there are issues around sort of housing and these kinds of other factors. It's not always clear to me that the police should be the first on the scene. There are in some cases there should be mental health services that are first on the scene. But then separate from that, Leon, let's talk about the poverty and the issues in the community that are feeding grounds for these issues. So, for example, summer youth employment. We need to make sure that these young kids have jobs. We need to make sure that our community, the workforce development is being provided so people are able to help get to the jobs that they want to have. We need investments in our community to help our small businesses and our entrepreneurs grow. I think those things are part of public safety as well. And so I want to make sure that we have a robust conversation around how we reimagine public safety in New York to not just have a law enforcement stick at the end process, but where we think about it holistically and law enforcement has its appropriate role within that conversation. That's my view of what New York City needs to look like. And the best way to do that is to make sure that we have a real sense of where is the money going now. Like I'm in favor of a precinct-by-precinct look at how spending is happening. You know, what are you doing in precincts like Central Harlem that is different than in precincts like the Upper West Side? I want us to look through that to make sure that we're investing most
that's interesting. Interesting.
Because
you're right.
Safety for everybody.
You're right. The Upper West Side does not have the issues that Central Harlem has.
Right.
They're treated the same way.
If I investigate this, Leon, and I see you have the same level of staffing in Upper West Side precinct that you do in Central Harlem, I now have to understand why we're doing that. So for me, I think we need to have a data-driven approach to a very emotionally charged issue that if we don't get resolved, is going to tear us apart as a country. And furthermore, you're not going to have people, after we get everyone vaccinated, wanting to come back to New York City if they don't feel like everybody is safe. And so I want to make sure that we get that done. I'm a unique candidate to focus on that. Secondly, we have to deal with the homelessness issue. And I think a part of the way that can be dealt with is we need to have, once and for all, a real permanent supportive housing solution in the city of New York. I believe with the $248 billion and the fact that we have a number of these hotels that are at the brink of bankruptcy, there's ways to actually have the comptroller to be part of investment vehicles, to purchase some of these hotels, partner with permanent supportive housing operators who are really good, and convert those places into permanent supportive housing, bring the services there, make sure people have access to all they need to have. It has to be the right kind of hotel, as you can imagine, because there's some certain services that are necessary. But I would rather spend money on trying to do that than on these temporary shelters that
just cost a fortune.
The city is
paying $6,000-$7,000 a month just to house them.
It makes absolutely no sense. So I want us to be focused on that, and I want us to get arms around just common sense of spending to ensure that every dollar we're spending actually has a productive outcome. I feel like there's not enough accountability and transparency around the spending. And then we always say, well, let's spend more. I don't mind spending more if I'm spending more for a result that I can see that is helping to make us safer, all of us safer, and helping people get the jobs and the opportunities that they want to have. We need someone who's going to take a business-like mindset to our city budget and root out waste when necessary, or just redirect spending, or to make suggestions around, hey, you know what, maybe the issue is not that we're not spending on the right thing, we're spending wrong on the right thing. Let's figure out what's the best way to do that. So programmatic audit, the comptroller's office can really be a place to provide that sort of information and accountability.
Right.
I'll
give you the first place to look. City jails. Rikers Island, population is down more than 50%. This year, they saved $12 million. The cost of housing an inmate in New York City today is $447,000. Now, I would suggest for $447,000, why don't we buy each inmate their own apartment, a studio apartment somewhere? You can buy probably for about $200,000-$250,000 in some of the nicest areas, and then set up aside a pension for the rest of the money so that they have every year an income of $20,000-$25,000. They have a free place to live for that $447,000. So that may sound like a joke, but
it really needs an audit. No, listen, my view is I think we need to put every idea on the table. And we need to be completely focused on how we are going, how we're keeping everyone safe. You know, one of the things that I've always said, because I'm, you know, obviously I, you know, I'm very much into police accountability, and that's an important priority. But the community safety is an important priority too, and so we need to figure all this stuff out.
How to combine them?
How to combine them? It shouldn't have to be one or the other. It shouldn't have to be either the police, right? And so for me, I refuse this argument that I have to be on this side or that side.
Right.
I believe that we should make this all work for everybody.
So I will tell you that very few people that are listening here will remember, but 25, 30 years ago, there was an incident in Borough Park where there was a person who was definitely mentally unstable. I guess that's the right way to say it. Mm-hmm. And he was out on the street. It was on 46th Street. I had my office around the corner between 16th and 17th Avenue. He was there with a hammer. And three or four police showed up, and eventually, you know, he was threatening to hit the cops with it. And they didn't have tasers yet in those days. And they shot him and they killed him. So you're 100% right. I don't think that you can send out, when you have somebody like that, you can send out a therapist, you know, to talk him down.
I think he needs
to be accompanied by a police officer. But the police officer, when they tell you there's somebody out there who has mental health issues,
mm-hmm.
to go along with a therapist, counselor, whatever you want to call it. And maybe later on they could take over the case, or, you know, once safety is secured, they can take it over. But a lot of the cases where the cops are being called, they should not be called. They should not.
Let me say this. We also have, Leon, we have precedent for this. You know what we call that? Whenever there's a hostage situation, we don't just send out the police with guns and batons. There is a hostage negotiation team, people who understand how to deal with those kind of matters, who are on the scene as well, because you want to resolve the situation where the least amount of lives, including the people who are the aggressors, are lost.
Right.
And so for me, I think from a comptroller's lens, I can kind of help lay out for the mayor and the city council and the public at large exactly what is going on, how we're spending, what are the, you know, and then we can ask those important questions. Well, and that becomes the mayor and city council's job, right? And the NYPD's job to figure out what they actually do.
The workings.
But we need serious attention on this issue, because it will destroy us if we don't get our arms around this issue of over-policing, excessive use of force, while understanding that policing is needed to help deal with community safety.
So let's talk.
We've got to put that in.
In the last few minutes that we have left, small businesses that are struggling.
Yes.
What can you do?
Yeah. So a couple of things. Number one, one of these are a number of small businesses are struggling because we need to get people vaccinated and we need to get people moving around in the economy again, right? I mean,
that should happen by the time you come to office.
That should happen. So then the question becomes, what are the issues that small businesses are having? Number one, a number of them have arrears because some of them just couldn't afford to pay
when they were closed.
So I want to work with the state and the federal government to figure out how we deal with that and how we help small businesses, particularly those who don't have the financial stability, to get back on their feet as they're trying to regrow their business. Secondly, I want to make sure that we're not over-stifling them with too much regulation. Hello?
Yes. I'm saying, yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
And particularly as they're, again, our small businesses have suffered. They're suffering. They're trying to get started again. We want to make sure that we are protecting the public. That's important. But we don't want to overdo it and over-penalize and over-hurt our small businesses, who are the backbone of our economy. Right. And where the majority of our jobs in communities like mine come from.
Right.
So I want to make sure that we can get people back to work. We got to bring tourism back. We can't get tourism back without the public safety issue being addressed and the COVID issue being addressed. And then help our small businesses with some of the issues that they have around the arrears and overregulation.
My guest has been Brian Benjamin, New York State Senator from District 30, which encompasses Harlem, East Harlem, the Upper West Side. He's running for comptroller. I have control in the office. He's running for comptroller of the City of New York. And I wish him good luck. And if you want to in any way support him, I'm sure he has a website that you can go to.
Yes, Benjamin2021.com. Benjamin, my last name, 2021.com. Please look out, and I'd appreciate any support we can get. You know, this is a race that is run on a grassroots level. The city has a matching funds program, an 8-to-1 matching funds program. So any financial support that you give, the city will match 8-to-1, which is a phenomenal benefit right to my campaign. So please contribute and hear more about what I'm doing.
Thank you, Brian, for appearing.
Thank you, Leon. I appreciate it.
Today I have with me New York City Council member of the 36th District, Robert Cornegie, who is running for Brooklyn Borough President. And for those that don't realize, Brooklyn Borough President represents 3 million people. And that would make us, I think, the fourth largest city in the country. Am I correct?
100%. Well, we're closer to 4 million people, but we'd right still be the fourth largest city.
Okay, so Brooklyn, well, we were closer to 4 million before the pandemic. I don't know where we are
now. Yeah, that's true, Leon. That's true.
So let's talk about what you as borough president, and as everybody sees as a ceremonial post, it is very far from a ceremonial post. It is a bully pulpit that you can use, but what do you as a borough president control?
Actually, our powers include and are not limited to land use, also zoning, and over $60 million annually of capital funding. So it is way not a ceremonious position. In addition, we can influence and add seats to community boards across the borough.
Right.
So those are significant. That's a significant ability to really help shape the borough. And in addition to the bully pulpit, which you mentioned.
Right, right. So I just want people to get a clear understanding of that. We'll talk about a few Jewish issues and a few general issues. Let's talk about that capital budget. Let's talk about, number one, what your idea is to do with $60 million, and that's annually, right?
That's annually, and right, my ideas center around making sure that this conversation of affordability is actually achievable by leveraging those dollars plus zoning plus land use to make sure that we become a very affordable place for average Brooklynites.
So you can use that $60 million to get to match up with federal money, with state money, and even with city
yes
money.
Of course, but really the ability to work within our ecumenical communities to make sure that the buildings are up to snuff, to make sure that the technology that's in our schools is up to snuff. So really influential in making sure that we are at the forefront of educational needs and issues, as well as some of the needs that we have as an ecumenical community and our buildings. I'm currently the chair of Housing and Buildings.
Right.
And in last legislative session, I was the chair of Small Business, which I think are the two pillars for true recovery and resiliency that we seek, not only as a borough, but as a city after this pandemic.
So as housing, let's talk about housing. How do you see the private housing sector, both as development and as owners?
So listen, I am a responsible development advocate. I don't believe also we can get to a place of affordability without having a relationship with responsible developers. When we've left the subject of affordability solely to developers, it hasn't worked well. When we've left the subject of affordability solely to the hands of government, it hasn't worked well. So this partnership between government and the private sector is absolutely necessary to get us to a place of affordability in the borough.
You don't see the private sector as the enemy of the people?
I do not see the private sector as the enemy of the people. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't know that as it relates to affordability, most of the affordable units in the city of New York and in Brooklyn in particular are in our smaller units, which are homeowners who have 8, 12, 20, 30 unit homes are the ones where the bulk of our affordability comes. So I've told people 1,000 times, as part of my recovery and resiliency plan, it is the support for small homeowners as well through this pandemic. There's this crazy narrative of canceling rent and all these kinds of things, and the immigrant community in particular has benefited by being able to purchase and grow their inventory as it relates to housing. I don't know how we can look in a different direction.
Would you see, you know, they're talking about taking basement apartments and legalizing them. Are you in favor of that?
I think, you know, there's a pilot program that is underway as we speak. And I think as a pathway to adding affordable units for smaller families and for single people, it could be a good pathway. We'll see what the pilot actually suggests in the long run. But safety there is an incredible issue in terms of basement apartments. We've seen over the history of New York, tragedies happen in basement apartments that were not converted in a way that makes sense. So I think there is a need for the use of these spaces that have been underutilized in some instances, but have been used illegally and unsafely in others. So there's a pathway there.
So first off, I think if you really look at the numbers, not that it's never happened, but it's rare. But there definitely can be done safely, which would mean, you know, a second means of egress, which is important, whether it's a window, it doesn't have to be a second stairwell. And if the city, you know, helps guide the small, whether it's private owners or even apartment buildings, I think there's a pathway forward to do it safely. Costs a little bit
100%.
More, but I think most people, if they had the ability to do it legally, would do it legally, which means a higher expense in doing it on a much safer basis. Let's talk about small business in general. I see it as the backbone of the city, all the small businesses. We're punishing small businesses just in every way, shape, and form. You know, I'm a real estate owner. I went 2 weeks ago to one of my tenants who's actually fixing up his store during the pandemic. He got his permit for the store, and then everything is moving along. He wants to put in a storefront. And they tell him, oh, by the way, you need a separate permit to put up a fence when you take down the old storefront. Why didn't you tell me this before? Why can somebody not file for a permit without an expediter? Why is there such a thing as an expediter in New York City? And I'm not here to knock any expediters. But the reality is that an owner and a guy that opens up a business, in order to get all the permits, is forced to hire an expediter in his area.
Listen, I think that anything we do that is not in support of small business owners and doesn't streamline their process, and like you said, getting these permits, if it's not streamlined, we've seen during this pandemic that between 35% and 50% of small businesses will not be able to return. We should not be coupling that with onerous fines and fees, with difficulty in permitting. I am the chair of Housing and Buildings, and will be leaving a legacy of streamlined opportunities for small businesses. We can't say that we support small business and that New York City is open for business with the way that we're conducting ourselves. It is a travesty. I get calls every single day from small business owners, some developers who actually are small business owners as well, with the processes, the fines and fees, the permits that are prohibiting them from going forward, even with affordable housing plans. I have affordable housing developers who are crippled as we speak to adding affordable housing units to the city's folio because of technicalities, which is ridiculous. So the amount of people we have who are homeless and or in shelters is
partially
because of our inability to get these affordable housing units online because of technicalities. Myself and the current borough president just had a huge press conference about the inefficiencies that we find in HPD and DOB as it relates to getting these units online. So there has to be something done, and I intend to continue to fight on behalf of small business owners and responsible developers to get us to a place that we streamline the finding, that we streamline the permitting process, that we reduce and limit the use of fines and fees to generate revenue. Fines and fees should not be a revenue-producing instrument for the city of New York.
Okay, let's talk about the Jewish community. Anti-Semitism is up the wazoo, especially in the Orthodox community. The attacks are enormous, constant. Where do you stand on anti-Semitism? And what do you see? How do you see about trying to help it?
So if you could allow me to, I just got to give context to why I feel so adamantly opposed to that experience in this country for my Hasidic brothers and sisters. There's the overt gestures that we see that escalate to the level of violence, and then there's the subtle bigotry and racism that exists with the name-calling, the spitting upon, which are also assaults to some degree, have been escalated and exacerbated by the administration, the former administration's way that it dealt with this. And some of our local electeds have exacerbated it, too, by not being supportive. As someone who had the pleasure of living in Israel, not, like visiting certainly on junkets with colleagues, but I lived there before I ever got elected. I had the pleasure of living in Petah Tikva.
Right. So you're not in favor of BDS, I take it, either.
I am not. I am absolutely not. And that comes from me being able to immerse myself in the culture there and realizing. I told the story very recently. I went there to play professional basketball.
Right. For those that don't know, Robert is 6'7", just a tad shorter than me. No?
No, 6'10".
6'10", sorry. Just a tad shorter than I am. And if you remember, when we take pictures, I'm always on a chair.
That's right. But Leon, let me say this to you. So I was there as a professional athlete. And every Israeli-born professional athlete that I played with while I was there had a commitment almost every single weekend to go and serve in the military. Right. So the level of patriotism, I had not witnessed that. So we have patriots, solid patriots here in the U.S., but there's never a time that we have to commit ourselves to protecting our homeland. I mean, obviously when we had 9/11, there was an opportunity to shift our mentality around protecting our very soil. But in Israel, while I was relaxing on weekends, my colleagues were there making money, playing a sport, had to commit themselves, not had to, but they did commit themselves to going and getting the latest training in an effort to be able to protect the state of Israel. I had never seen anything like that. So when we have these conversations about the state of Israel and protecting the state of Israel and BDS, my contextual life tells me about looking at these young men and in some instances now, women who are participating in military service out of an abundance of patriotism and the idea that they were raised with this idea that they had to be at the ready at all times to protect their homeland. That's a different context.
Right. After spending 3 years, I think it is, in the Army, then they do for till they're, I think, 45 or 50, they do what's called miluim, where they go in for a month, or maybe it's 3 weeks now, every single year, to get, like you say, updated training, technology, and everything else. But it's...
And then when I returned to the States, I had established friendships there, and I watched very well-to-do Jewish families send their young people back to Israel to be trained as well. So you would think that, okay, now I'm here in the United States. I'm immersing myself in the United States culture. The state of Israel may take a second seat. No, they were sending 13, 14, 15-year-olds annually to be trained.
Well, they're not
combat.
Being trained at that age, at 13, 14,
well,
15.
Well, they were learning. Right. And maybe it was classroom training. I saw really young people going, maybe not to carry weapons,
Right.
But to understand the culture.
To understand the culture of the country, that's for sure. Summer camps, where there's a lot of good training, but they're not taking kids out, at that age in the Army. I don't want people to get the idea that Israel's a militaristic country. But
right.
One last issue, Jewish education.
Yeah, so look, again, I got to frame this with a context. My policy and legislation is informed by what happens at my kitchen table. I have 6 children of my own. I have seen every facet of the Department of Education school system. So I've had a child who was in gifted and talented. I've had a child who had an IEP, with speech and language delay. Right. My oldest son got his GED, and my last 3 children were in charter. Without parent choice, there was no way I could put each and every one of my children on a pathway to being successful. I got a daughter who will be attending Columbia in the fall on a graduate school, and all of my children won't be going to Columbia graduate school, but I was able to find a way, because of parent choice, to put everybody on a pathway to be successful. So I believe parent choice, whether it's in the DOE school system or whether it's in religious education, is paramount. We cannot take that away from parents, their opportunity to choose what's in the best interest and to resource those things appropriately.
So Robert Kornegi will be running for borough president, and that's just around the corner, June 22nd, am I correct?
Yep, it seems like a lifetime away and tomorrow at the same time.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Leon, for this opportunity.